Today's episode is brought to you by Cars.com. With over 2 million vehicles and 50,000 more added every day, Cars.com will match you with the perfect car for you, your budget, your life, your style. And if you're ready to say goodbye to your current car, Cars.com will get you an instant offer to cash it in. Just start by entering your license plate and get matched with a local dealer who will write you the check. So whether you're looking to buy or sell, just go to Cars.com. It's magical.
I have Dan Angelo Russell on the record saying that Byron Scott is an idiot. And he would tell me that he took the longest route possible to get back to the bench whenever he got subbed out of games.
Oh, boy.
He always seems to get involved, doesn't he?
I'm telling you, too many coconuts have hit him right on top of the skull.
I think Anthony will be a great acquisition. He can do it all.
Avery, who shows this?
Welcome, everybody, to the Anthony Irwin Show. I am Anthony Irwin. Today on the show, we have a really fun guest lined up. He is of Bleacher Report. He wrote a book on tanking, which Lakers fans have a little too much experience with, to be quite frank. Jake Fisher, thank you very much for hopping on. How are you doing today?
Thank you, man. I'm doing well. How are you?
You know, I've moved on far enough from the Lakers foyer into tanking and stuff. And so just reopening some of these wounds, I might cry at some points of this episode. We'll see how it goes. But yeah, that's kind of where I wanted to start. I want to start kind of broader. We'll go into the Lakers stuff and then we'll break off into some more general NBA stuff. But tanking as a concept, it was like this huge taboo word with Sam Hinkie and the process and Daryl Morey, you know, him leaning into it as well. And now there are teams that are doing it, maybe not so brazenly or whatever, but it's just become part of the NBA. And I'm kind of curious, you know, from your tracking of the concept from those days where it was all anybody really wanted to talk about to now, why is it just accepted? Like, Sam Hinkie must be livid that he's no longer allowed to work in the NBA. And everybody's just like, yeah, it's just how things go.
Yeah, it's a great point. I mean, I'd honestly argue that teams like OKC and Orlando and Detroit and Houston this year tanked more baldly and brazenly than Sam ever did, to be honest. But I think it came – I mean, the book exists, and the title is it's Built to Lose, How the NBA's Tanking Era Changed the League Forever. And you know, that's – Built to Lose implies that it's a strategy exacted by the people who are building these rosters, right? But it wasn't just Sam Hinkie. You know, at that time – all these analytical-minded executives were coming to power. We had Rob Hennigan in Orlando. We had Ryan McDonough in Phoenix. Pete D'Alessandro in Sacramento. David Griffin comes to power in Cleveland. You know, all these analytical-minded executives kind of stemming from Daryl Morey and Sam Presti and Danny Ainge even is kind of like the real godfather of all this, having overseen Daryl in Boston first. They all kind of – the numbers proved what history has always shown, that dating back to the 50s and the 80s and the 90s, teams who win championships – pretty traditionally, they have multiple all-stars on their roster. And if you want to do the most efficient, you know, team building strategy possible to going from the middle or the bottom or wherever you're starting to get to the top, the best way to do so is through the draft. That's the easiest way. It's the most the most unblocked path to do so. And if you do draft those guys, you can look at, you know, the Miami Heat was a great example back then where they draft Dwayne Wade, they build a contending team around him, and it's enough to draw LeBron and Chris Bosh from free agency, and the Heat are running the league at the time that all these executives are coming to power. So they all kind of agreed, you know, we're not going to beat Miami anyway. And this 2014 class with Wiggins and Jabari Parker and Joel Embiid and Julius Randle on down was considered to be at the time the best class since 2003. So all those factors lined up. And I think this concept of hope and this more streamlined conversation we're now having about team building, it's now allowed this strategy to come into the mainstream and be an accepted form of roster construction in the mainstream.
It's hard for me to, I don't think it necessarily has to be an either or kind of a thing
where you either build the way the Lakers did, where LeBron just wants to come to the Lakers and Anthony Davis wants to come play with LeBron. And then you have the role players who want to play for the Lakers and with those guys.
Yeah.
Or like you're saying, building through the draft. And obviously Lakers fans are going to say, well, we prefer what they just did recently. Like this was, we didn't have to watch the team be that terrible. And we were just, this was way more fun to just fall into LeBron. Whereas that isn't really a path, an avenue that is available to the vast majority of NBA teams out there.
Nail on the head.
And so I'm kind of, you know, for those analytically driven minds who really do throw themselves fully into tanking, and given the response to Rob Pelinka and his building of this Lakers team, is there animosity between those GMs who have to build through the draft when they look at a Rob Pelinka or they look at Pat Riley when they were able to build the Miami Heat? When free agency is a viable way to build a team, those GMs who can't necessarily build that way, do they look at those other GMs as like, man, that'd be nice?
They do. I mean, I say the book is a bunch of different case studies of the same abstract, where, you know, Philly is the bold example in that time period where they just tore down a middling roster and were bad for a couple of years and really swinging moves on the margins. You know, Boston, they moved on from KG and Paul Pierce probably a bit too early, right? Obviously, mm-hmm. Flamed out in Brooklyn, and they got a massive haul back that turned into Jason Tatum and Jaylen Brown that has set up. You know, obviously they've crumbled a bit of late, but they made 3 out of 5 conference finals, and they did a pretty damn good job of building a team around those guys before it's kind of.
We don't compliment the Boston Celtics on this.
It's gone to crap. But the Lakers were in there because, like you said, they had the largest margin for error of anybody. You know, I, as you probably know as well as anybody, from 2012 to 2017, that 5-year stretch, the Lakers had the worst record in the entire league, and they still signed LeBron in 2018 anyway. Like, most teams don't have that margin for error, and that's why I thought the Lakers were really interesting to include, being that they had the same situation. I mean, obviously, they were going back and forth with Boston all throughout the last half of that 2010 decade. And they still said, no matter what, like, we're building around Kobe. We don't care that he tore his Achilles and then he hurts his knee and his shoulder and all this other stuff, We're building around this guy because that's what we do. And they ended up inadvertently getting into the tanking conversation because of that. But it didn't matter anyway because LeBron and then Anthony Davis wants to come to play, like we just said. So I think all these other smaller market teams especially, but even bigger markets like Houston's a huge market, right? They're like the 4th, 5th biggest media market in the country. But James Harden requests a trade to Brooklyn and they're automatically right back in the situation of, we got to be the worst team because we're not getting a guy in free agency anyway. So I think what your point is, I think, very emblematic of this theme all across the league for teams that aren't Brooklyn or the Clippers or the Lakers or, you know, even the Knicks, maybe even this summer in free agency.
Do you think that dichotomy, that juxtaposition between, you know, where the Lakers are, what is available to them, and the small markets thing, you have kind of a unique perspective on league health. Like, I just had Howard Beck on the show last week, and we were discussing how ratings, I don't think, should really be the end all be all for the health of the league. I think the health of the league should actually be interest in good teams, no matter where those good teams are located. Yeah. And because there is player infatuation with large markets or player infatuation with playing with each other, right? Because of those things, you do kind of feel like there are probably fan bases out there who feel like they can't win. So what would you say to a fan base who feels like they can't win? And even if they do draft James Harden, or even if they do draft whatever superstar it is that they draft, that player might leave. There's already whispers about Zion Williamson potentially signing his qualifying offer. Yeah. So those fan bases who feel like we have to build through the draft, and then even then we only have 7 years to convince this guy to stick around. What do you say to those fan bases to actually continue to show passion for this league?
it's an issue. And I think, you know, a big side effect of all these analytical minded executives coming to power, like we've talked about throughout this, is it's streamlined the conversation about team building and roster construction to even the most casual fans out there. And it's been great to drum up interest in the offseason, this whole 11th month news cycle that we talk about. And it's fun for fans to be able to Photoshop Dame Lillard into their jersey and say,
right now, you know, it's Luca because of the Cato report. Yeah.
Exactly. And like, that is, I guess, good for fan engagement, but it's also really devalued the actual value of the games in the regular season. And to your point about when the league is at its healthiest, I think it's when the majority of teams' fan bases want to pay to show up to that arena that night, thinking that any given night they've got a shot at winning that game. And maybe that's, you know, flawed logic in that it'll never really happen, right? I mean, traditionally throughout the league's history, there's always bad teams. But I think even still, you know, a 30-win team or a 28-win team being the worst team in the league, that's obviously much different than a 17-win team. And I do think that the league's got have a situation that they need to reckon with here. I think that's why they're, you know, really thinking about creating a midseason tournament. I mean, I reported a Bleacher Report a couple weeks ago that the G League next year is absolutely planning to institute a start of season tournament thing where, you know, they'll break the league calendar basically into two seasons where everyone will do a little tournament and then the top four teams will be in a 4-team Final Four and there'll be prize money and all that type of stuff. Like, look at coaches' challenges and I'm blanking on another example, but
rule changes. Yeah.
In general, the way the history works of the G League experimenting things, if it's successful and people like it in the league, it comes to the big level pretty soon. Like, we could see a mid-season tournament thing in the next 2-3 years, honestly, from conversations I've had with people in the league office and, you know, top officials and team front offices. Like, I do think that we're trending that direction, and it's absolutely stemmed from wanting to generate more interest in the regular season. Absolutely.
Yeah. They need to do something. You know, I just think we just saw it this year where teams, I think it was kind of unique to the season because the last season happened so soon before the season kicked off and all that for some of the teams. So you saw a lot of teams basically and players and superstars say, look, we are just going to try to survive this season. I don't care how many games that we miss. We're just going to try to get to the playoffs. And it still didn't work for a lot of superstars anyways, in terms of staying healthy. You mentioned the Lakers, you know, trying out and you used the word inadvertently tanking. Yes. And I think that's an important word. It's an important descriptor here in discussing what it was like when they were tanking there, because it never really felt like they were all in on tanking. They just did a lot of things that a tanking team would do, like hiring Byron Scott to teach a bunch of young kids and employing Kobe Bryant for $40 million over 2 years after he blew his Achilles. So they did a lot of things. I think Zach Lowe kept calling it like shadow tanking, right? He was just like, we're tanking, but you don't know it. And I'm kind of curious, like from your sourcing, your reporting and writing this book, which again, it's Built to Lose, how the NBA's tanking era changed the league forever. You reported on a few of the details of that tanking experience for the Lakers. Was it something they were ever comfortable with? Like, was it something that they ever really believed was a long-term viable solution to building their team?
I think obviously everyone knows that 2012-13 season was supposed to be a glorious year in Hollywood, right? The whole Dwight Howard trade, the sign and trade for Steve Nash. This is going to be fun. SI cover, like, it was supposed to be a thing. And
that season never happened. I don't know what you're talking about.
And it very quickly, you know, derailed everything, especially when Kobe tears his Achilles. And at that point, I mean, I think it was very similar, not to, you know, bring up old wounds and that are opening, you know, present day ones too, with, you know, now there's another 30 plus, you know, wing player who's all of a sudden starting to have lower body injuries and his mortality is starting to look legitimate. Like, that was a real thing with Kobe at the time too. Mortality of his career, obviously. I don't want to convolute anything. But I think the Lakers still, from reporting I've done, I mean, I think also a big factor at that time was the fact that Jim Buss passed away.
This is advertiser content brought to you by Frito-Lay.
Hello, I'm Chip Murphy, here to get you ready for the big tournament. Tonight we'll break down... We break down who will be cutting... Cut! What are you two doing?
Sorry, Chip. Prez here got his feathers ruffled when I told him Ruffles has zero chance of winning the title.
And I was letting Dip know that she is not taking into account Ruffles' iconic ridges.
Guys, it's March. We have to start talking about the tournament.
We are. It is the 2023 Frito-Lay Snack It.
We're talking about big-time matchups between Cheetos, Smart Food, Lay's, Sun Chips, and more.
Just head to the Frito-Lay Snack Bracket and vote for your favorite chip, pretzel, or dip for a chance to win up to $1,000 or a year's worth of snacks.
This sounds great. Keep up the good work.
Just go to Frito-LaySnackIt.SBNation.com. No purchase necessary. Sweepstakes ends 4-3-2023. Void where prohibited. Here's worth of snacks awarded in the form of 52 coupons, each good for one bag of chips. See official rules at Frito-LaySnackIt.SBNation.com.
And you know, Mike D'Antoni's brother, Dan D'Antoni, was an assistant on that staff, and he gave me this great quote saying that Dr. Buss was the control tower overseeing everything, and every single department reported to him. And when that, you know, when that figure was gone, it really sent a lot of uncertainty throughout that franchise. And the one thing that everyone did agree on, though, was that Kobe was Kobe, and that in order to get the next generation of superstars to join him, to take the mantle from him, they needed to prop up Kobe and have them join him and show this loyalty to him, both financially, with that two-year contract that we can definitely get into, and also in terms of trying to build the contenders around him, like the conversation we're hearing now about Golden State with Steph and Portland with Dame, about maximizing his championship window. And they thought that message would get out there to other stars, and maybe it did. Like LeBron, you know, still came in 2018. I think LeBron watching Kobe's big retirement tour in 15-16 played a huge role in him realizing, like, I can come here and be honored and be the next part of this Lakers legacy. But there was a lot of complications that came with it, being that they never did get that guy. And I think a big part of it stemmed from, they had real designs to try to get LeBron and Carmelo in 2014, like you mentioned, and they just shot themselves in their own foot by giving Kobe that 2-year, $48.5 million deal. When I've got people, Lakers officials, telling me for this book that they believe Kobe and Rob Pelinka would have taken half that number. So not only would he potentially have taken less money, but they signed it early in the season in that November, which prevented them from having the cap space to have two max cap spots. Mm-hmm. So they could have waited to sign Kobe and obviously use the cap gymnastics to go over the cap, over the tax, to re-sign your own player. But they only had one max cap spot available. And from my reporting, I do think Carmelo was down to join the Lakers on a discounted deal, but LeBron wasn't. He told his agents told every single team that they met with in Cleveland that summer, you know, we're signing the max, because LeBron realized from Miami, like, you know, we have to maximize our own earning potential. If LeBron James isn't getting his maximum salary, how can any player in the NBA go to their ownership and say, you know, I deserve my maximum salary too? So it just, the cap gymnastics prevented the Lakers from ever getting LeBron and that and Melo at once. And that kind of, you know, then kickstarts this whole couple year period where they just start filling the roster with 1-year deals and hoping they can get back into free agency every summer. Mm-hmm. Obviously, you know, it didn't work out.
Right. I wanted to ask about LeBron and Melo specifically, based on what you have heard in the years since then. Like one of the talking points back then was that LeBron was a little iffy about playing in Kobe's shadow, and you're saying that Melo was down, which I could understand. I know he really wanted to be on one of the coasts. If Kobe signs the discounted contract and they do have those two max spots to be able to offer to Melo, to be able to offer to LeBron, where they don't have to take discounts to come join Kobe, would they have been okay with playing in Kobe's shadow? Because we saw what that looked like with Kevin Durant playing in yeah. Steph's shadow, and it didn't look great.
I think there was definitely a cause for concern at a certain point when they didn't get a meeting with Kevin Durant. I think that was another big wake-up call. But I think Lakers officials definitely started to worry at times that, that Kobe's shadow was definitely too big for a lot of his people. They didn't want to come in and be, you know, his second fiddle. I mean, look at, I mean, this is a situation that I think gets talked about a lot when we have these team building conversations. Like, these stars are all stars for a reason. And the one common thread they have is they're competitive people who, you know, think they're the best guy on the court. And to their credit, like, you can't be that good in a competitive business without thinking that way. That happens in investing and Silicon Valley and whatever. This is happens to be sports where you're on a stage where everyone can see you and have podcasts debating your rankings and all that type of crap. So, and we saw it with Kyrie in Cleveland, right? Like, as much as he won a title with that team, he did not want to be considered the number two to LeBron. He wanted to be partners and co-stars. And that's what he has in Brooklyn right now. And I do think the fact that Kobe's legacy was reigning over everything, I do think that played a big role in having a lot of other superstars say, you know what, I don't necessarily want to come in here and be the second fiddle to Kobe, being that he also is aging. And who knows what his role is going to be moving forward anyway.
They were going to be playing second fiddle to a player who might not be as good as them. Like, that would be, it's a really awkward kind of situation there. Yeah, the whole LeBron Melo thing is also interesting in this regard. Obviously, LeBron eventually comes to the Lakers anyway. And one theory, one pervasive theory out there is that, you know, that Kobe contract, while it hamstrung them at the time, long-term superstars are saying, well, that loyalty suit to a superstar is actually kind of nice. We saw Danny Ainge ship out Kevin Durant and Paul George. And we saw the treatment that Ray Allen got when he went to Miami and he went back to Boston, and whether it was from the players, the fans, and whatever. But I'm kind of curious if you think that Kobe, I believe you called it a golden parachute contract at the in your book.
That's what someone told me it was called.
Yeah, I think that was Clay Moser, right? Told you they called it the golden parachute for the executive on his way out or their way out.
Yeah.
So I that term is interesting to me because it is a you know, Kobe was more than just a superstar to the Lakers. And most superstars want to see themselves, especially now in the era of superstar empowerment, they want to be seen as more than just the superstar. They want input on coaching decisions and they want input on players and all of those things. So you saw Kobe kind of have that. And then on his way out of the organization, get that last deal there. Do you think showing that kind of loyalty to Kobe paid dividends potentially in landing LeBron, you know, so many years down the road?
I do think so. I mean, you want to talk about decision-making behind coaching hires. I mean, I have it pretty much on the record in the book that they hired Byron Scott for those last 2 years just to kind of be like a steward for the final 2 years of Kobe's deal. He was a sitting duck coach from the second they hired him, but they did that, you know, really. I mean, he wasn't developing those young guys. Like, I have details in the
book. That's for damn sure.
D'Angelo Russell in the book called Byron Scott an idiot. Like, he has. I have D'Angelo Russell on the record saying that Byron Scott is an idiot, and he would tell me that he took the longest route possible to get back to the bench whenever he got subbed out of games, so that he didn't have to even walk past Byron Scott. Like, that's a big thing, and I think
walking around the building, it's just like
I went and looked at like a YouTube, like an old game. Like, if you go back and watch old games, it's very obvious when D'Angelo comes out of the game, he's like going to the very far end of the court to not have to high five Byron Scott. Like, there's definitely calculations at play in every franchise that they do to try to cater towards superstars. But I will say, you know, Jim Buss and Mitch Kupchak were, you know, steadfast in saying, we're going to get a star. Like, we're the Lakers. We're going to get a star. And yeah, their tinkering and the moves they made to try to set that up for years didn't work out. But I do think that their belief was kind of vindicated when LeBron re-signed in 2018, or not re-signed, signed.
Signed.
And the second he does sign, you know, sure enough, there's automatically those rumors about Anthony Davis. And that's the testament of this whole thing too, right? You need to get a star to get another star. Mm-hmm. And I think you're right. I think they did benefit inadvertently from, you know, pleading to Kobe and placating Kobe and all that type of stuff for years. But they obviously didn't benefit for a big period of history
initially.
Sure, like you said at the top, maybe Lakers fans will take that, but that's something that a lot of franchises just can't afford.
Yeah, I'm curious. We kind of touched on the era of superstar empowerment, and that's where we kind of find ourselves right now. Do you think in some way it was response to tanking? Because so one of the things that, fair or unfair, I kind of tie to tanking and the analytical minds in organizations is treating players like assets, not necessarily I'm not going to go so far as to say that it has completely dehumanized athletes in the sport, but it is certainly, it's a lot easier for, you know, players to be moved and fan bases to move players and contracts and draft picks and all of those things as we have all become kind of pseudo GMs away from the team. Do you think the superstar empowerment era was kind of a response from players to say like, no, we still run this league. You can come up with all the numbers and this path to success organizationally if you want. But at the end of the day, like if Kevin Durant and Kyrie Irving want to play together, and if LeBron James and Anthony Davis want to play together, it's I think it's fair to wonder if tanking is still as viable as it was maybe a few years ago.
Well, think about this. This is a thesis I pitched to a lot of executives, and many did agree with me. Others were like, I don't know about that. But I really believe that, you know, look at Philly, right? Their situation gets mischaracterized all the time. A lot of people say, oh, 5-6 years of losing. It wasn't. They really bottomed out for 3 years. And I think if Joel Embiid doesn't get hurt a second time, there were clear evidence that they were trying to build towards 2016 free agency and try to get good then. Like they hired multiple Texas staffers who had connections to Kevin Durant. They hired people who had connections to LeBron. They hired people who had connections to Kyle Lowry. Like they were definitely trying originally to build up in 16. But, you know, if you are willing to say to a Joel Embiid or a Ben Simmons, like we're willing to punt multiple seasons because of the opportunity just to even have a chance to draft you, that's how valuable you are. I don't know how that doesn't then further show these players how valuable they are and how much agency they do have and how much, you know, the franchise's overall state of success does hinge upon that player being there and being happy and being healthy and being on the court and playing to his ultimate, you know, maximum potential. So I think that played a clear value. I mean, look at Zion, like you talked about the top. He has no, there's nothing standing between him and realizing that I am everything for this franchise right now. David Griffin willingly going out publicly and willing to get fined to say some bogus comment that he got hurt because of fouls. Like that he's doing that to placate the Zion. Like, I don't understand how these players, how tanking didn't play a role in further making these players realize that we have a lot of say in this ecosystem. The NBA at the end of the day is a marketplace and a business far more than it is a sport. And I say that to people all the time, that the actual, what happens on 48, between 48 and zero on the clock is like less than 1% of the whole NBA behemoth. And I think, you know, a big factor of that now and that being, I think kind of getting exposed and written about and reported on is as much a testament to these players feeling like they can do kind of what they want. And I think that's been a big, I think that's been propped up by tanking. Absolutely.
Do you think tanking can still be as successful or building only? Well, nobody really builds. I think that's another misnomer. I think that people have associated with tanking and building through the draft is this notion that like Philly was only going to have success through Ben Simmons and Joel Embiid without adding any, like that they ever thought that that was how they were going to go. All of these teams, you know, they wanted to draft at the top of the draft as often as possible, but they also understood at some point you need to bring in a veteran to be able to win during those draft play and teach those young players how to win during their windows. But so tanking as a concept and building through the draft as a concept, now that these players do have as much agency over the league as they do you think we'll still see it in the same way? Or do you think, you know, how are those analytically inclined GMs and executives, how are they adjusting to the way that the league is running now where, hey, superstar A, superstar B, and in Brooklyn's case, superstar C all want to play together.
Yeah.
That's just how that's going to go.
Well, as we've seen, that's only really happening in a couple markets like we talked about before, yeah, too, right? And look at this very year. This 2021 class is ironically considered to be the best class since 2014. Mm-hmm. And we saw OKC, Detroit, Houston, Orlando all do stuff that was far more brazen than anything Hinkie ever did. Sending Al Horford right home for half the year and John Wall sitting courtside healthy watching Kevin Porter Jr. take his job, and the Pistons just waived Blake Griffin and now he's starting, you know, on a team that ended up
finals.
You know, winning the finals. So, I mean, I think it's alive and well. And I think when you're, especially when you're a small market team who you can't benefit from those superstars saying, I want to go play with you, unless you're Milwaukee, right? Drew Holiday re-signs because they drafted Giannis Antetokounmpo. They didn't get Giannis mm-hmm. number one, but they drafted him. And that's a really obvious, example of you draft your superstar and other all-stars will want to then come play with them. So I think we're going to keep seeing it as long as your draft position is dependent on your record. We are going to see teams eventually lose games on purpose. You know, the Thunder obviously were doing pretty hot. They're right in the mix of that play-in tournament up until Shai Gilgeous-Alexander twists his ankle, and all of a sudden Al Horford's going home for the half of the year, and the Thunder are plummeting down the standings. Like, mm-hmm.
So you think it'll get more brazen? Like, you think the response to the superstar empowerment, it'll keep getting louder and louder? They just won't use the terminology. They won't attach tanking to it. They'll just say, oh, no, we just, darn, Al Horford had vacation plans in the middle of the season.
Yeah. I don't know if it'll get worse, but when there's expectations that there's a big pool of players at the top, like, this is a five-player draft, right? That's what mm-hmm. everyone says. So the Rockets, they're still guaranteed a top five pick. They have 100% chance, no matter what the lottery odds are right now, they have 100% chance of getting a top five pick. So mm-hmm. they might even find themselves at a better position, number one, because then they don't have to make that choice. The best guy just falls to them. The mm-hmm. best guy of that group. I mean, you could pull 15 NBA GMs right now and they'll all rank those top five guys: Cade Cunningham, Suggs, Mobley, Jalen Green and Kuminga, they'll all rank them differently. Mm-hmm. So like if you get the fifth pick, you don't have to make that tough decision that could ultimately cost you a job, just like yeah. we talked about, before yeah. too. So I still think even a 14% chance, I was talking to people with the Bulls the other day who, they have only a 20% chance of keeping their pick that they traded for Nikola Vucevic. But you'll take that when you look at, we traded two first and this for Vucevic. Well, it's actually only one first, and the other first, we've got a 20% chance that it's still being a top four pick. Like, that's stuff that the Bulls are excited about. So mm-hmm. I think people are still going to be willing to play the lottery as long as the odds are still what they are.
I mean, people play the actual lotteries knowing that the odds are terrible. So I guess you keep doing your thing. Do you think Sam Hinkie ever works again? Does he want to work in the NBA again?
I don't think he does. I don't want to speak for him definitively, but conversations I've had over the years with him and people around him, I think, getting realized, or him realizing that even when an ownership group says to you, we're giving you carte blanche to exact this plan, and you got a couple years to do this, the rug can get pulled out from under you and you're fired just like that. He didn't get fired, obviously, but the writing was on the wall and yeah. he got pushed out. And mm-hmm.
By the NBA to a certain extent, like Adam Silver kind of stepped in and said, hey, here's a Colangelo,
Yeah. Well, if you want to get into that, I can give a quick synopsis of basically Josh Harris, the Sixers owner, and Adam Silver. They have connection through Adam Silver's roommate in college, was a partner, with, Josh Harris at Apollo Global. And Adam Silver went to Duke, and who was the Duke head coach forever? Mike Krzyzewski, who was Team mm-hmm. USA's Olympic coach, who was run by Jerry Colangelo. And, he comes into power and starts operating. And, Jerry's big ultimate dagger to Sam was, they wanted to push forward this idea of bringing in a co-GM, which is unheard of in the league. Like, obviously, right. we've got presidents and their executive VP and their assistant GM and all that type of stuff, but pretty typically outside of the owner, there's one guy who's got ultimate final say before that stuff gets put on the owner's desk. And to give someone who had probably the most agency of anybody in the league, swinging deals left and right, all of a sudden to say, we want you to work with somebody else. And one of our preferred candidates is the guy who we brought in, son, like the writing's on the wall. So yeah. I think the fact that he has this venture capital fund he's trying to do and other investment Silicon Valley type stuff, and he's teaching business in Stanford. I don't think he has interest in joining the league anymore. I think he lived his dream and he also was in Houston for 8 years before he even got to the Phillies. So mm-hmm. I think he's on to the next chapter of his career and his life.
That's too bad. I think I thought he had really good ideas. It was just a branding issue. Pablo Torre is probably kind of responsible for Sam Hinkie's downfall. All right. Just quick segue here before we get you out of here. We have two things. One, this postseason kind of moves along, we're going to start getting into rumor season. You're starting to see the leaks and counter leaks from the less successful teams trying to explain why so-and-so wasn't responsible and so-and-so should have been responsible or should be held more responsible. And then that is going to give way to teams starting to plan for the future. And I'm just kind of curious, you're really plugged in throughout the league. And do you think this is going to be a very based on what you're hearing so far, do you think it's going to be a very active offseason, or do you think most teams are just going to try to take whatever data that they can possibly assemble from a very flawed and very weird season and just try to run back their general concepts that they had this year?
Yeah, I think a bunch of teams are reckoning with their identities, and those are the ones right now that have head coaching openings. I mean, mm-hmm. Indiana, Portland, and Boston, I read about it today for Bleacher Report. Like, all three of those teams, they're facing a pressure with this coaching hire. They need to hire somebody who will push that team further into the postseason than the previous people did before them. And especially with Indiana, like, they need to have some stability there. And I think there's other situations. I mean, everyone around the league expects Mike Budenholzer to be out in Milwaukee if the Bucks don't reach the finals. So that opens up another opportunity. And there's ripple effects with these other ones. Like, I reported today that Nate McMillan is a name that people are whispering that Boston really has their sights set on, even though everyone does expect him to re-sign in Atlanta. Like, let's say Nate McMillan goes to Boston, that opens up a whole another coaching search in Atlanta. I mean, I reported that Rick Carlisle potentially has eyes on Milwaukee's opening if that does happen. And obviously Tim Cato's reporting today, sheds a lot of light on why Carlisle might have interest in leaving that situation. So, yeah. I mean, that would then open up a coaching thing in debt. Like, there's so many ripple effects and dominoes that need to fall. And a lot of them are depending on postseason success. Like, if Brooklyn's health doesn't, keep them, or prevents them from beating Milwaukee, that presents Philly and Boston, two teams that have a lot riding on this postseason, how much more exponentially greater chance at winning the title versus, the Clippers. There's talk about if they can't get past Utah, what that means for that front office. Like, a lot is still to be determined, but I think there is going to be a lot of change. And the free agent market, interestingly enough, is going to be controlled by the New York Knicks, who were obviously the big story of the year, and they flame out pretty brilliantly in the first round. So
yeah,
there's going to be a lot still to be determined. But I expect there to be a lot of fireworks. We're in uncharted territory where I think the league is spinning faster than it ever has. And maybe we're getting to the point where it's flying really close to the sun and everything might explode. But right now, I think it's spinning at a pace that we're not used to, but it's still, not off the tracks yet, but it's definitely spinning really fast and people are playing catch up left and right.
It's even going to be a shortened off season because the NBA is trying to reset and get back to their typical season schedule. All right. Last thing before we get you out of here, this is something we do with all of our guests here on my show. I am kind of known for on Twitter for my terrible layup in summer league that Harrison loves to throw on there as often as he possibly can. That's one of my most embarrassing sports moments. So do you have an embarrassing sports moment that you can think of off the back of your head when in your playing days or if you had playing days or whatever?
It's not embarrassing being that people found out, but I was a very bad baseball player in my youth. And I only played 1 year. It was in third grade. And I was basically stuck in right field in a league that had all right-handed hitters. Ball never came to me. And one day, the coach took it way too seriously. This is third grade baseball.
Yeah.
And one day,
Bobby Cox,
that head coach was gone for a, whatever. He wasn't there. So the assistant coach very nicely decides to put me at third base for one inning. Mm. And I really had to pee as we're starting to warm up for that inning. So I peed my pants to stay in the field and be there for my team. Not for my team, for myself. Yeah. I wanted my moment at third base. And I don't remember how I performed, but I definitely remember like the gray pants I was wearing and seeing like a darker gray line start to trickle down my thigh. So that is something that, you know, is embarrassing to say, but I don't think anyone really noticed. So I don't think it was embarrassing in the moment.
That's one of those. That's one of those times where you don't want the ball to come to you, though, because that's when people notice, right? Then they're looking at you and like, "Hey, what's up with your pants?"
Yeah, I wanted the ball to come to me so I could make my play and prove that I had some talent, even though I didn't have any talent. I was always only really a good basketball player, but teach their own.
So that coach was your coach, Sam Hinkie, tanking and putting you at third base.
Pretty much.
That's fantastic. Well. Thank you very much for being a sport there. That's a great story. It's better than Aaron Larsoul telling me about the time as a kid that he blew his knee out, I think twice in one game as a kid. And then Howard Beck told me last week about how he tried to Eurostep around Tim Bontebs and blew out his knee. So you have the top spot for stories on the show.
There you go. Thank you.
All right. Well, again, check out the book, Built to Lose, How the NBA's Tanking Era Changed the League Forever. I'm about midway through it. It's fantastic to this point. It's really, really good. You guys are going to enjoy it as well. And then check out all of his reporting and his writing at Bleacher Report. One more time, this was Jake Fisher. Jake, thank you very much for hopping on.
Thank you, man. The book's available Amazon, bookshop.org, Barnes & Noble, Triumph Books, wherever you want to buy your books. And I got a partnership going with La Touraine Watches, LATOURAINE. If you buy a watch, you get a free copy of the book too. So please support. There you go. As Anthony said, you're not going to be disappointed if you cop a copy.
Absolutely. All right, that's going to do it for this episode. Check out Lakers Lowdown tomorrow as I react to some of this stuff and then all of that stuff as well. So have a great one. We'll talk to you guys next week.
Thanks, man.